likely to die before reaching maturity. However, food insecurity was already spreading across the globe before the pandemic due to the conflicts, economic recessions, and climate change. That's why nearly all low- and mid-income countries have experienced economic downturns in 2020. Low-income countries are more vulnerable to food price shocks in particular. While a surge in consumer food price inflation predates the pandemic, early lockdown measures and supply chain disruptions induced a spike in the prices. Also, higher transport costs increased consumer food inflation. Some experts believe that food scarcity will probably trigger social unrest and bring people out into the streets, which is likely to make the next few months unstable.
Well, I think that we have to understand that the food problem is not simply a result of the COVID problem, but it's also a profound problem as a result of climate change.
...2020 posed a serious blow to food security around the world, and the effects of the pandemic are expected to linger. In 2030, an estimated 30 million more people may face hunger than would have without the COVID-19 outbreak. Many factors affect food security around the world. Therefore, a food system approach is required to find effective solutions. A report by the State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World has recommended a number of actions to help prevent undernourishment. Those include increasing resiliency to conflict, climate change, and economic shocks, and sustainably ensuring access to affordable, nutritious food.
What we have to understand and what we should, as a society, be doing is encouraging increasing local trading systems and community-supported farming organizations such as those that exist around the world. It's called community-supporting agriculture, and they're very, very important because they provide a counterbalance to the increasing control and the lack of diversity that the large corporations are offering.
Food insecurity has been on the rise since the mid-2010s, especially in countries affected by conflict, climate extremes, economic downturns, or battling high inequality. The pandemic only exacerbated these existing challenges, with significant negative effects, particularly for poor nations. Therefore, things are not going to change for better unless nations across the globe start working together.
On Friday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein at the State Department. The meeting comes ahead of discussions on the role of U.S. military forces in Iraq. U.S. media have cited American officials as saying that the two countries are expected to formalize the end of Washington's combat mission in Iraq by the end of the year. That shift is reportedly planned to be announced on Monday when U.S. President Joe Biden hosts Iraqi Prime Minister at the White House. It could potentially mark a new chapter in the ties between the U.S. and Iraq, 18 years after Washington deployed its troops in the West Asian country. In an interview, the Iraqi foreign minister said the presence of American combat units in Iraq is unnecessary at this stage. He said what Iraq needs is cooperation in intelligence and training, as well as Air Force support. Earlier this week, Iraqi Prime Minister also stressed that American combat troops should leave his country.
I believe that the U.S. will not fully disengage from Iraq. My guess is they will leave some troops there in at least an advisory capacity, and also that they will augment the official military with private contractors. I don't expect the U.S. to totally leave Iraq.
In the meantime, resistance movements in Iraq say the presence of the U.S. forces in the Arab country will only benefit Israel. Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq have been running high since January 2020, when Washington assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, along with the deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. Following the assassination, the Iraqi parliament adopted a resolution that called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. Iraqi resistance groups have pledged to take up arms against U.S. forces if Washington fails to comply with the parliamentary order. While the U.S. justifies its presence in Iraq with fight against Daesh, Iraqis are stressing that they don't need foreign troops and that they're capable of dealing with the issue themselves.
The U.S., at least at times, has assisted groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and I expect the U.S. to continue to do that. The reason the U.S. will stay in Iraq is to be able to have a base of operations from which to attack Iran and Syria and other countries and entities in the Middle East that the U.S. deems to be enemies.
On the other hand, the fact that apart from Daesh terrorists, the U.S. is the only perpetrator of attacks on Iraq's anti-terror popular mobilization units, which are legally incorporated as part of the Iraqi military, puts the U.S. claim of fighting terrorists in perspective.
Britain has announced the permanent deployment of two warships in the South China Sea amid growing tensions between the U.S. and China. Britain's Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said the U.K. will permanently assign two ships in the region by the end of this year. He made the announcement in a joint press conference with his Japanese counterpart in Tokyo on Tuesday.
Following on from the strike group's inaugural deployment, the United Kingdom will permanently assign two ships in the region from later this year, as well as contributing a littoral response group in the coming years to come.
Japan is a close ally of the U.S., and it hosts the biggest concentration of U.S. military forces outside of the U.S., including ships, aircraft, and troops. The deployment would be after a strike group consisting of U.K.'s Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier and escort ships sailed through the waters in the South China Sea in September. The Queen Elizabeth is being escorted by two destroyers, two frigates, two support vessels, and ships from the U.S. and the Netherlands. It will come to Japan through the South China Sea, parts of which are claimed by China and Southeast Asian countries, with stops in India, Singapore, and South Korea. In a statement on the deployment, Pentagon spokesperson congratulated Britain for its, quote, commitment to an interconnected network of allies and partners who mutually cooperate and support freedom of navigation and a rules-based order in the Indo-Pacific region.
These are actually illusionary entities. Yes, they have sets of laws and they are separate countries, but the globalists who run the United States and the United Kingdom work together as one entity. So what we have is two countries in which the citizens are taught from young age that they live in a sovereign state. But in fact, the two countries of the UK and the US are both under the basic control of a globalist elite.
The South China Sea is a gateway to major sea routes through which about $3.4 trillion worth of trade passes each year. China claims sovereignty over much of the strategic waterway and has, since 2014, built artificial islands on reefs and installed military bases on them. UK's Defense Secretary has said that London would also eventually deploy a littoral response group to the Pacific. That's a unit of Marines trained to undertake missions including evacuations and anti-terrorism operations.
The UK and the United States function as one entity, especially when they have a common target, which in this time is China and, in a secondary level, Iran.
UK's latest policy announcements are in line with the US's anti-China drive. The Biden administration's approach toward China is taking shape. Many believe Biden will continue the policies of his predecessor to contain China. While the U.S. has seemingly reduced its involvement in West Asia, the American military has sought to refocus its attention on preparing for a conflict with its major rivals, China and Russia, which it considers to be major competition in the insatiable U.S. quest for power and influence. However, Washington's economy and military power is on the wane, and whether Washington likes it or not, it has to change its warmongering policies and adopt a rather more cooperative one, something that is not likely to happen anytime soon.
The United States runs what it is typically called a protection racket. You must pay to buy United States weapons and defense systems in order not to be threatened by the boogeymen that they create out of other independent countries. So the United States is always leaning on its so-called allies because, in effect, with the exception of England, with the exception of the UK, all of the other countries are military protectorates or socio-economic and military colonies of the United States.
How the Biden administration actually deals with thorny issues between the two countries is yet to be seen. It will depend on how China responds to U.S. actions. Given the strong negative public sentiments towards each other and their increasingly divergent domestic political practices, the truly benign strategic competition still remains difficult, if not impossible, to achieve.
The Israeli regime is in hot water over a major scandal triggered by revelations that an Israeli-made spyware has been sold to some governments to target journalists, dissidents, and political leaders. Data leaked to an international alliance of news outlets shows the Pegasus spyware was sold to a group of countries, including the repressive regimes of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates, which have notorious human rights records. It has been disclosed that Israel's Ministry of Military Affairs played an important role in choosing the customers that can buy the cutting-edge cyber spying tool. Some sources say Israeli authorities pushed for Saudi Arabia to be added to the list of customers that get the spyware. International pressure is mounting on Israel for enabling gross abuses by approving export licenses for the powerful spying tool to these states. Why was Tel Aviv so eager to make sure regimes like Saudi Arabia will have the sophisticated tool?
It helps them to control their countries. It helps to get them to be on the same side as Israel, because that's typically repressive regimes find Israel to be a, you can call it a good alliance, if you will. So this is what's happening, and it's happening now with the repressive Arab regimes in a way that it did not happen in the past.
U.S. media recently reported that Israel encouraged the technology company that developed Pegasus to continue to cooperate with the Saudis, even after it was revealed that the regime ordered and planned the gruesome assassination of outspoken journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. The Israeli regime seems to be trying to control damage from the scandal. It has set up a task force to manage the fallout from the revelations amid an international outcry.
Iranian citizens throughout the years.
Investigations show that the Israeli spyware has been used against prominent activists, journalists, politicians, dissidents, or those close to them. A case in point is Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was killed and dismembered in Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul. The mobile phones of a number of people close to him, including his wife, were allegedly hacked into by a Pegasus operator. A close friend of Khashoggi, who was the ex-director general of the Qatar-based Al Jazeera network, is believed to have been targeted. Meanwhile, outspoken Saudi women's rights activist Lujain Al-Hathloul was apparently another victim. The Guardian says she was selected for possible hacking by Pegasus just weeks before she was arrested in the UAE in 2018 and then forcibly returned to the autocratic kingdom. Meanwhile, an investigation suggests that Princess Latifa, who was running from her father, the ruler of Dubai, was captured in 2018 using the Israeli phone hacking spyware Pegasus. The Washington Post reports that phone numbers of friends and associates of the princess were on the long list of phone numbers of people believed to have been targeted using the spyware. Israeli authorities seem to be having a tough time trying to contain the scandal, as major Western media outlets are involved in revealing the details. Israel, with its top-end surveillance capabilities, has always been a major player in the spying world. Many observers believe the revelation suggests that the regime will not hesitate to share experience and technology in the field with governments that it wants to be friendly with.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station, Choo Choo Kachoo. It's the Youth Station for you. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio today, we have with us Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
It's great to have you.
My pleasure.
So we've been talking about your adventures in Zimbabwe, and you've had lots of thrilling stories that you have to share with us. Now, obviously, if you go on a trip, especially to a country that you've never been to before, you're bound to encounter some surprising things, things which stand out for you. Were you in Zimbabwe in Muharram?
We arrived to Zimbabwe a few days before Muharram, and our journey was mainly for the university.
In the UK, for example, even if you had certain cultures, Indo-Pak culture, for example, or Khoja culture, or Iraqi or Afghani, if you go from one community to another, it could be that one community, you know, they're more expressive.
Mm-hmm.
And then another community, they're just not. Yeah. Even though they share the exact same culture. I don't know how it works, but...
And I mean, even, for example, the way that people beat on their chest might be very weird to some people. I mean, the way that Iranians or some Pakistanis, they go to majalis and they beat their chest. If a person coming from some of the Western countries who have no idea about mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, it might be very weird to him. And so it's very important for especially the preachers to take into consideration all these differences in cultures.
No, of course, yeah. I mean, in London, I remember them doing, we used to have the Arba'een March in I think it's Trafalgar Square. But I saw a culture of people, I don't know where they were from, they looked kind of Arab, but I really couldn't tell. But they started, I can only describe, they were jumping up and down in the air. And
it happens in some of the very private sessions in Iran as well. I've seen some videos from them. Some people call it harwale. They want to, as you mentioned, they jump. And they have their own justification for that.
Is it a kind of Sufi, mystical connection that they're...
They do not call it Sufi. Maybe it is mainly practiced by the youth. When they do that, they feel more, let's say...
Connected?
Not connected. I mean, at the end of the day, the youth, they want to mourn in a way that they come to this conclusion that they have done the best for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So they beat on their chest, they jump, and it gives them more energy maybe to continue and to beat on their chest more and more.
So did you see anything strange like this in
No, not at all. Because at the end of the day, as I mentioned, there are, I mean, very few Shia in Zimbabwe.
Right.
I mean, in the whole country, maybe we have about 2,000 Shia only. And so they are not many in number. And we had beating on the chest in a very normal way, which was done by Lebanese, Iranians, and the native Shias. I didn't see anything weird.
I've heard that some out there, non-Muslims, know Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and they know of him or about him, they know about his message, even if they don't know much about Islam itself.
For me, what happens in, I mean, what I understood was that those people, even inside the university, the students and the lecturers, the professors, they did not know much about Islam at all.
Mm-hmm.
And only those two or three professors which were supposed to teach about Islam, they knew a version of Islam that they were taught. But apart from that, they only had heard something about some of these doubts against Islam.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't see any non-Muslim Zimbabwean to have heard about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In the month of Muharram, I tried my best in my classes to explain, because I was wearing black. I did that intentionally so that maybe one of the students would ask me the reason. And so I repeated like for 2-3 days, and finally one of them asked, and I explained about the whole movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. No, I didn't see but they have heard about Imam Khomeini. Maybe in one following session I will explain about the viewpoint of at least some of the professors at the university and their very positive understanding of the personality and character of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi.
But we're going to come back to this, inshallah, after a break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back to the studio. We've been talking about Dr. Karimi's trip and his adventures to Zimbabwe. Now, I'm just curious, what about the demographics that you faced over there? We talked previously about the interest that people showed towards Islam and the Jehovah's Witnesses and how our tabligh efforts are not as good as they could be or ought to be. But now I want to gauge the reaction of the people in Nigeria. And you said that you received a number of comments and questions about Islam.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, were these questions from the older generation, from the younger generation? Were they from the men or from the women? Which demographics did you note?
In that conference that was held in the University of Zimbabwe about the status of women in Islam, Christianity, and African traditional religions, the audience were between maybe 20 to 40. They were mainly Christians. So the question that I received against the Islamist position about women were from these people, mainly Christians.
Were they women?
Both.
Uh-huh.
But maybe most of the questions came from the women. I mean, the addresses were both men and women. I'm not sure about the percentage, but the questions came mainly from the women because, as I mentioned, they did not know much about Islam, but they had heard all these doubts and objections against Islam when it comes to the position of the women, like the superiority of men over women, like violence against women in Islam, like polygamy and so on and so forth.
Now, obviously, a big part, an element of Islam is unity and Islamic unity. We're brothers in Islam. How was there a reaction when they found out there is a difference between Sunnis and Shias?
They did not know at all about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as I mentioned, even except for 2-3 professors who used to explain and teach courses on Islam, the other even lecturers, professors in the faculty that I was teaching, and for sure the students, did not know anything about Islam, let alone to know about Shia and Sunni school of thought. Because of the fact that, I mean, when you are teaching the history of Islam and doctrine of Islam, in some points you need to explain the fact that there are two major denominations, Shia and Sunni. In all my classes, the students, they knew that, they came to know that there are differences, and what I'm teaching is from a Shia perspective. And I also explained to them the Sunni perspective in some of the, like, doctrines of...
Would you say that there was, like, a shock, or... Not shock, but curiosity? Did they
become
more curious?
Not at all, because they have all these differences in Christianity as well.
Right.
So, most of them, they were Protestant, and even when it comes to Protestantism, there are many subdivisions among the Christians in Zimbabwe. So to have different denominations was something very, very normal and usual for them.
Right, right. Now, we've talked about the different kinds of ways that people in the Shia communities express their love for Imam Hussein, mm-hmm. alayhi salam, and how they carry out certain practices. In the major Shia communities throughout the world, we see that there is a kind of system established in where they have sort of community centers, and they have preachers or resident alims, we call them,
mm-hmm.
and they kind of focus on the community, and they grow the community, they nourish it, or at least in theory that's what it should, you know. Practically it might not always materialize, but that's the kind of established system that has been created by generations of Shias. And I believe that a lot of this has come from Iran. For example, the practices, reciting Hadith Kissa before a speech, and mm-hmm. the khutbah, and giving salams to Imam Mahdi ajalallahu ta'ala faraja sharif at the end, and all these kinds of things. These are kind of traditions which we have adopted. And the question I want to ask you, Dr. Karimi, is to what extent do you feel this has had an effective role in nurturing future Shia generations? And off the back of that, how can we push this culture out to countries such as Zimbabwe?
Because of the fact that I've not been in those countries that you're talking about, I'm not sure if this is related to what you mentioned, but I've heard that one of the problems, because you refer to the fact that different communities, they have their own centers and mosques. Sometimes I've heard that, for example, the Iranians, let's say in UK, they have their own center. The Iraqis, they have their own. Pakistani.
I mean, it's very sad, but that's the way it is.
So if this is also coming from Iran, I think it's not a good souvenir from Iran to take it to other countries. I mean, in and of itself, it's good for Iranians to have their own center. Maybe they can invite in Persian-speaking scholar. The Pakistanis, they invite Urdu-speaking scholars.
No, I didn't mean that. I meant, like, you know, for example, even having a minbar.
Mm-hmm.
Where did this concept come from? Doing, you know, the chest beating afterwards, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Where did this culture actually come from? All these things, how much have they... And they are predominantly positive things, while there may be some negative elements to them, but how much did these things affect the spread of Shiaism?
It's a very, general and difficult question, because I think we need to talk about each and every element one by one. Some of them might be positive, some of them might be negative, but maybe the role of the, resident scholar is what matters the most. It is the role of the scholar, the preacher, who is going to give a lecture in these different communities to come to this conclusion which part of this culture is positive and which part is negative. For sure, those positive ones can help the community to grow, spiritually speaking. And when it comes to countries like Zimbabwe, in which we do not have a resident scholar, at least a top scholar from Shia countries, then it is the role of some political centers, like the cultural counselor related to Islamic embassy of Iran in Zimbabwe. Alhamdulillah, in some countries these people, I mean, the head of this cultural counselor of Iranian embassy is very active.
It's been a fascinating discussion today where we've been talking about all sorts of things, actually. We've been talking about the conditions again, about of Zimbabwe. We talked about the fascinating journey of the dear Sheikh. From myself and from Dr. Karimi, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator. My Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker, abiding in silence with patience and guidance.
In the limelight. President Joe Biden this week marked the end of the first 6 months of his four-year term. And as Biden knows from his time as second-in-command to President Barack Obama, it's never too early to get to work making sure Democrats hang on to other elected officers. Biden campaigned on Friday night, 23rd of July, with Virginia Democratic gubernatorial nominee Terry McAuliffe in Arlington, marking the first formal campaign appearance by another candidate Biden is making as president. Terry McAuliffe, who held a top job in the Old Dominion before, hopes to succeed the fellow Democratic governor, Ralph Northam, who is term limited from running for re-election this fall. The article you're about to hear has been written by Susan Milligan, a senior political writer at U.S. News & World Report. The piece is titled, Biden Goes Back on the Campaign Trail. President Joe Biden this week marked the end of the first 6 months of his four-year term. And as Biden knows very well from his time as second-in-command to President Barack Obama, it's never too early to get to work making sure Democrats hang on to other elected officers. Biden campaigned on Friday night, 23rd of July, with Virginia Democratic gubernatorial nominee Terry McAuliffe in Arlington, marking the first formal campaign appearance for another candidate Biden is making as president. Terry McAuliffe, who held a top job in the Old Dominion before, hopes to succeed fellow Democratic Governor Ralph Northam, who is term limited from running for re-election this fall. Virginia has gotten increasingly blue in its politics in the past dozen years, and Democrats now hold every statewide office and control both chambers of the state legislature. But gubernatorial elections in Virginia are always competitive, notes Kyle Kondig, a political analyst with the University of Virginia Center for Politics, and Democrats aren't taking this fall's race for granted. While Joe Biden won Virginia by 10 percentage points in 2020, the president's party typically does worse in the governor's race than they did in the state beforehand, in the presidential election, Condict says. The drop-off can be pretty stark, he adds, giving GOP nominee Glenn Youngkin a viable shot at taking the governorship back for his party. Joe Biden, the nationally watched race in Virginia is an early indicator of the political support he may or may not have as he continues with his legislative agenda. Democratic governors already outnumbered by Republicans, 27-23, and losing Virginia would be both a numerical and a psychological blow to the Democratic Party. The race is also the start of an uphill effort by Joe Biden and the Democrats to hang on to narrow majorities in the House and in the Senate. Democrats have just a 5-seat majority in the House and control the 50-50 Senate only because Vice President Kamala Harris casts the tie-breaking vote. Historically, the president's party loses seats in Congress in the midterm elections. Barack Obama suffered what he conceded was a shell-lacking in 2010, when Republicans gained 63 seats in the House, the biggest single election gain since 1948, and with it, control of the chamber. Republicans also gained 7 Senate seats, but did not take back the majority. Rarely a president's party bucks historical trends. President George W. Bush, for example, benefited in 2002 from a good GOP year that had his party gaining seats in the House and taking control of the U.S. Senate. But Bush was still riding high in the opinion polls in a post-9/11 country, an unusual political dynamic. Joe Biden could also buck the trend, Condict says, since Republicans picked off some of the swing seats in 2020, leaving fewer contested races. Biden is also popular, though not as much as Bush was in 2002, which means a presidential visit could boost some vulnerable Democrats. Biden has yet to campaign for a House incumbent, but his domestic travel schedule has favored places where his party will face competitive races in 2022 and in the next presidential race. So far this year, Joe Biden has made multiple visits to Wisconsin and to Pennsylvania, where open seats for the U.S. Senate next year gives the Democrats a chance to pick up seats, to Georgia, where Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock faces a tight re-election effort, and to Ohio, North Carolina, and Florida. Presidents typically spend the first part of a campaign year raising money for candidates, then start traveling for them after Labor Day, the year of the election, Condict says. Joe Biden is not a polarizing person, but he's not someone who I think is going to excite people either, Condict adds. Still, it's always a big deal when the president goes somewhere, so Biden's travel should give a boost to Terry McAuliffe and others, he says.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. future. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate. June 4th, 2021. The televised speech delivered on June 4th, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. In 1329 and 1330, according to the solar calendar, the years marked by the national movement, a certain movement came into being, bringing the people to the streets, thereby nationalizing Iran's oil and snatching it away from the English. However, 1-2 years later, an English and an American coup was launched, helping Mohammad Reza to resume another complex and very dangerous dictatorship for long periods of time. These incidents have taken place in the world. They were anticipating that fate for us by looking at the past. However, not only was the revolution and Imam Khomeini's system not dissolved, and not only did it not come to a halt, but it also became more powerful on a daily basis, refusing to surrender and to back off. It displayed and showcased its independence with each passing day. It accomplished great feats and overcame the obstacles, and they created so many obstacles on the way of this revolution and this system. All sorts, including political, economic, security, and various other obstacles. The Islamic Republic overcame all of them, and it galloped forward. Today, the Islamic Republic is more developed and advanced than when it first began work 40 years ago, and it is better in every aspect by God's favor and grace. Subhanallah, alhamdulillah. The secret to the survival of the Islamic Republic. Well, a question arises here about the secret to this survival and this progress. Why did the Islamic Republic not suffer the same fate as other political systems and revolutions despite all that enmity? What is the reason and what is the secret of this? I will tell you that the magnificent and pride-generating secret to the survival of this system could be summed up in two words: Republic and Islamic. The harmony between these two is the secret to the survival, and the organism that has been formed out of these two words should be protected, both the Republic and Islamic aspect of it, both the people and Islam. Republic means people, and Islamic means coming from Islam. This is the same as religious democracy.
Oh,
In the limelight.
Torrential rain has flooded roads and tube stations in London after thunderstorms hit the south of England on Sunday, 25th of July. Barts Health NHS Trust declared a major incident after the flooding led to problems at Whipps Cross Hospital and Newham Hospital in the east of the city. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Jane Clinton. The piece is titled, Thunderstorms Leave Roads and Tube Stations Flooded in London. Torrential rain has flooded roads and tube stations in London after thunderstorms hit south of England on Sunday, 25th of July. Barts Health NHS Trust declared a major incident after the flooding led to problems at Whipps Cross Hospital and Newham Hospital in the east of the city. A statement from Barts Health NHS Trust says, "We're working closely with our local partners to resolve the issue and maintain patient care. While services remain available for people in an emergency, patients are asked to attend alternative hospitals where they can to help us put solutions in place as quickly as possible." Police had to close a road in southwest London where three double-decker buses were stuck under a railway bridge, according to a journalist from Agence France-Presse. The driver said passengers had to get off the bus after his bus started taking on water. Other motorists in Walthamstow, northeast London, had to abandon their vehicles because of flooding. It was also reported that some residents there were in waist-high water in their homes, with emergency service called to rescue them. Portobello Road in West London was also deluged, according to social media posts. The Met Office and Environment Agency rain gauges showed there was 48.5 millimetres of rain in 1 hour in Bethesden in Kent, between 3 and 4 p.m. on Sunday. There was 38.5 millimetre of rain in 1 hour at Ryde in the Isle of Wight, and 20 to 30 millimetres of rain in 1 hour in parts of London and nearby counties. The London Fire Brigade said it had taken 300 flooding-related calls in just a few hours on Sunday, 25th of July. The Standon Calling Music Festival, which had been taking place in Hertfordshire with a capacity of 15,000, was called off because of the flooding. Standon Calling said on Twitter, "If you can safely leave the site this evening, please do so as quickly as possible. We are working on getting everyone off the site as safely as quickly as possible." The Environment Agency on Sunday, 25th of July, issued 5 flood warnings across the southern parts of England and 19 flood alerts, which included parts of Wales. A yellow thunderstorm warning was in place until midnight on Sunday, covering an area of the south from Norwich to Plymouth. An amber warning for thunderstorms had previously been issued by the Met Office for parts of southeast England, including the London area, during Sunday afternoon and early evening. Met Office meteorologist Stephen Keats said The storms were being caused by a convergence of air currents as warmth in the Earth's surface from the recent heat wave rose to meet cooler air in the atmosphere. Weather forecasters said on Monday, 26th of July, would be a slightly quieter day in the south, with a few locally sharp showers and some heavier showers across the north of the United Kingdom. However, through the coming week, the unsettled weather will continue and further rain and thunderstorm warnings will be issued for Tuesday and onwards.
Around the world with reporters.
This is exactly what's happening to our whole society today.
This year's International Coots Day Conference was held to coincide with the 7-year anniversary of the 2014 Coots Day massacre. The carnage happened when 35 members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria who are protesting the persecution of Palestinians by the Israeli regime were killed by Nigerian army troops. On 25 July 2014, a street protest was marred by the fatal shooting of dozens of members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, including three biological sons of Sheikh Zazaki.
We are marking the 7-year anniversary of that dark day because it was shocking to us and it was shocking to many Nigerians, whereby three of our leaders' biological sons were gunned down. They were taken to the barracks, to the army barracks. They were tortured to death. Meanwhile, 30 of our members were gunned down.
In a statement, the Nigerian army said the soldiers acted in self-defense, a claim the Islamic movement dismissed as preposterous.
That's nonsense, because they dispatched a contingent of the Nigerian army to go and lie down in a nearby farm, a sugarcane farm, bottle ready, armed, well armed, as if they are going to meet a soldiers of another country, a foreign country. And then if they say they acted in self-defense, where are the guns they recover? They recover from the 33 people they kill. They were just bloodthirsty criminals who are ready to kill the Shiite community.
Sheikh Zazaki and his supporters were still mourning the 2014 Coots Day massacre when another mass killing took place in Zaria in 2015 at the hands of the Nigerian army, resulting in the deaths of over 340 other members of the movement. Meanwhile, Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat have remained in detention in the Kaduna Correctional Center. A Kaduna State High Court judge is expected to issue the final ruling on the Sheikh Zazaki case on Wednesday, July 28, where, according to his lawyers, no case can be made against the Islamic cleric. Anjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Based on a statement released by Afghanistan's Ministry of Interior, to curb violence and limit the Taliban movements, a night curfew has been imposed in 31 provinces across the country, except in Kabul, Panjshir and Nangarhar. This comes as many have argued that imposing a night curfew means that the war is in the own backyard of the residents of cities across the country, a fact that can further spread fear and concern among locals. Many others view this as an indirect call on the locals to take the threats coming from Taliban advances seriously and resolutely stand alongside Afghanistan's National Defense and Security Forces to defeat the Taliban.
The night curfew highlights the government's need for public support in fight against the Taliban. We have to put our weight behind the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces.
Talks between Afghan government and the Taliban have failed to achieve a tangible result so far.
The nighttime curfew will make the things difficult for Taliban. They will be deprived of free maneuvering even behind the entrance gates of some cities. This is because they will be targeted easily by the Afghan armed forces.
Afghan troops have recaptured some areas in a western city which was attacked by the Taliban. The Taliban, who have stepped up their attacks since the withdrawal of the foreign forces, insist that there would not be peace in the country until the removal of President Ghani from power and presence of a new negotiated government in Kabul. In response, the Afghan government argues that the militants need to firstly put their guns on the ground and approve the Afghan constitution as a red line for both the government and people. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Sit back and enjoy the beauty of Iran's ancient culture. In Kushk Art Garden, located in the heart of Tehran, visitors get to learn about Iran's music, literature, painting, and calligraphy, far from the hustle and bustle of modern life. Kushk hosts Iranian artists who create masterpieces that have their roots in thousands of years ago.
Miniature painting has been around in Iran since thousands of years ago. In miniature, we paint flat images with a myriad of details. We avoid adding shades to make it as flat as possible, since in the past, Iranians believed that divine light gives shape to everything.
Metal engraving first stepped into existence 7,000 years ago in Iran. It is the art of incising decorations and metals. In this workshop, I will be available every day for visitors to see how I can turn metals into beautiful handicraft.
Kushk is part of a bigger project dubbed Art Garden. The cultural complex consists of an art lake, poem and literature house, music house, and Kushk Garden, each trying to promote an aspect of Iran's culture. Tehran municipality says it inaugurated the peaceful place, for it says cultural identity has been overshadowed by modern technology.
This precious place was a much-needed initiative to preserve the Iranian art and culture. As time goes by, technology gets more and more intertwined with our daily lives, and our genuine culture slips into oblivion. We need to have such cultural centers that safeguard our cultural heritage.
The Art Garden is situated on Abbasabad Hills in downtown Tehran. In recent years, the area has turned into a tourist attraction that houses structures that combine modern technology with ancient culture, such as large pedestrian overpass called Tabiat Bridge, and the Middle East's largest planetarium, dubbed Mina Dome.
Kushk will be the last piece of Tehran's art garden, and will be a hotspot for a range of cultural activities, all aiming to revive the ancient Iranian art and culture, which experts believe have become a lost piece in today's hectic life. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
More victims of a malicious Pegasus software hacking scandal have been revealed, as phone numbers of several prominent British Muslim activists have appeared in a leaked list of successful hacks by the Israeli-made spyware. The list includes Raghad al-Tikriti of the Muslim Association of Britain, Mohammed Kosbar of Finsbury Park Mosque, Baroness Paula O'Dean, and Anas al-Tikriti of the Cordoba Foundation. Mr. Al-Tikriti suspects he was hacked by agents from the Emirates over his past criticism of the regime.
I've had a long-standing struggle with the UAE, and simply because over 10 years ago, I highlighted the fact that the UAE had persecuted and followed on by a prosecution of dozens of reformists, of people who called for democracy, who called for accountability, who called for transparency in their own country. It's a scandal. It's a complete scandal, just like all the scandals that engulf us, unfortunately, on every single level. Infringing on someone's entire life. I mean, this Pegasus software, apparently, I'm no technician, but I understand that I'm being told by experts that it basically takes control of your mobile phone, which essentially is, and this is, you know, something that humanity needs to contend with, is our entire lives.
At least 400 British citizens have been targeted by foreign regimes using Pegasus. Yet number 10 has remained stunningly silent on the matter.
How on earth could Great Britain, no less, be blasé regarding 400 of its citizens being attacked in such a callous, obscene, despicable manner by a regime that is not